Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Elizabeth Colbert is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sixth Extinction. She returns to humanity's transformative impact on the environment, now asking, after doing so much damage, can we change nature, this time to save it? Her new book is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, which explores different nature-altering technologies, both in existence and in the abstract, and how these technologies could help solve planetary problems or could become problems themselves. This show was recorded as part of a virtual event with Oblong Books and Music, oblongbooks.com. Elizabeth Colbert is the author of Field Notes from a Catastrophe and The Sixth Extinction, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. She's also a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Elizabeth Colbert back to this week's book show.
How are you?
I'm okay, Joe. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a delight, as always, to see you. The new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. Let us start with the title. Let me just say this at the beginning. This book can be taken both ways, right? It can either scare the hell out of you, or you can think to yourself, wow, there are these people doing these really amazing things that maybe will eventually scare the hell out of us. I don't know. You can read it both ways, can't you?
No, absolutely. And I think that people will find themselves, you know, each chapter takes on a different intervention, if you will say, in the natural world, sort of ways that we're intervening to try to correct for previous interventions, some of which you'll not, people will say, yes, that's absolutely true. Some of which already exist, are already happening. Some of which, as you say, are more sort of futuristic. And some of them you may well say, yeah, that's a great idea. And some of them you may say, that's the scariest thing I've ever heard of. And you may find yourself flipping back and forth between the two.
So when it comes to Under a White Sky, talk to us a little bit about how that title came about.
So as you suggest, you know, it's a little bit of a spoiler here. It's the end of the book. For the last, one of the last chapters in the book, I spent a bunch of time with scientists at Harvard who run something called the Harvard Solar Geoengineering Research Program. And the idea behind solar geoengineering is that we've already, you know, changed the atmosphere very dramatically. And now we might, by loading it up with carbon dioxide, warming the climate. And one of the real challenges for dealing with climate change is that it's very hard to do something about it quickly because carbon dioxide hangs around in the atmosphere for a long time. So if you get a climate that you don't care for, that really is dangerous, and unfortunately we may be heading there, one of the few ideas that people have come up with for how you could arrest climate change is by intervening again in the stratosphere, putting up particles into the stratosphere that would reflect sunlight back to space, bounce sunlight back out to space, and actually reduce the amount of direct sunlight that hits the Earth. That would have a pretty immediate cooling effect that theoretically, at least, could counter the warming effect. And one of the many, many potential side effects that this intervention could have is it could change the appearance of the sky. So instead of, you know, if you went somewhere where nowadays you would expect a pretty unpolluted part of the world where you'd expect to find a bright blue sky on a sunny day, the sky would have sort of a milky tinge. And that's the source of the title, Under a White Sky.
Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. So when it comes to these interventions, and often interventions to deal with interventions, this becomes obvious in the book, obviously, but I'm curious as to your take on it of do these usually come from a good place in the beginning?
Yes. I mean, I think in all of the cases that I talk about, either people thought they were doing something, you know, good, or they were just unconscious. You know, I mean, climate change is the unwitting impact of our leading modern lives, you know, driving around, flying around, heating our homes with fossil fuels. So, you know, no one intended climate change, but it's happening. Some of the other interventions I talk about in the book are, for example, you know, people introduce species into different parts of the world that turned out to wreak havoc, but their intentions at the beginning were good.
So let's talk about you read about New Orleans in the book, and so you can tell us what happens there, but obviously you have an area that is being besieged. It is having difficulty. We know this from Katrina. We know this from a lifetime plus of storms and damage. And so we work like hell to try to fix it. And while we're doing that, well, New Orleans is disappearing.
Well, that's a very stark and, you know, sort of clear example of this phenomenon that I'm talking about, where, you know, New Orleans sits on a delta that naturally over time, as the Mississippi created the land that New Orleans is on, it used to overflow its banks every spring, basically. It would deposit a lot of sediment across the landscape. That's how all of the Mississippi Delta was created. And over time, these different, what are called delta lobes, would sink away and a new lobe would be created. But we built, you know, New Orleans on this delta lobe. And now we have to try to protect it. And the way we've tried to protect it is by preventing the Mississippi from flooding. Now, by preventing the Mississippi from flooding, all the incredible waterworks, the levees, the flood walls that, you know, keep the Mississippi in its banks, they have had the unintended side effect of preventing new sediment from spilling across the landscape. So all of southern Louisiana is disappearing very fast. It's said that southern Louisiana loses a football field's worth of land every 90 minutes. And New Orleans is one of the fastest sinking places on earth. So the new sort of intervention to deal with the intervention is to try to now create controlled flooding, to basically open up these cracks in the crevasses, they're called, in the levees, that will themselves be controlled. And then you'll let out this water when there's a lot of sediment. And you will try to, as I say, create this controlled flooding to counteract the effects of flood control.
Does this become an ever-ending cycle in this case? I mean, because it's possible, if nothing is done, that New Orleans could just wash away, right? So you do this, but then you have to wonder, and I'm sure obviously minds are thinking about this, but then what damage is that doing?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, New Orleans has grown up in what really would be a temporary part of the world. And now as you try another case of this, for example, is we're constantly pumping water out of New Orleans. New Orleans is basically beneath sea level. So we're always pumping. When rain falls in New Orleans, you have to pump it out. That pumping also has the effect of, you know, fostering this subsidence, this sinking. So everything that we do to sort of try to keep New Orleans from going under has the effect, is a double-edged sword, unfortunately.
And that's the case with many of the stories that you tell in the book, that there is a double-edged sword to it, right? Either it started that way or that's where we are now.
Yes, and I think that one of the sort of messages and themes of the book is these systems are very complicated. And, you know, you sort of draw a line here and say, this is what we're trying to do. But a lot of, you know, the system is a lot more complicated than that. It's not just an on-off system. There's a lot going on. And so, for example, in southern Louisiana, the whole area is referred to as a coupled human and natural system, or a CHANS. It's this interconnected way in which our own engineering and the geology of the region have now become so intertwined that you can't really tell where, you know, human engineering and the natural world, where the human engineering ends and the natural world begins.
And it's hard to figure out, Yes, where one begins and the other ends, and where the other ends and the other begins. But I also get back to this idea of what is good and bad, and the idea of, well, for want of a better term, playing God, and what and what that means.
Yeah, I mean, that comes up pretty explicitly in the book. You know, I allude to that quote, pretty famous quote from Stuart Brand, you know, we are as gods and have to get good at it.
Right.
Which has, you know, been countered by people like E.O. Wilson, who will say, you know, well, unfortunately, we're not as gods. We're pretty incompetent. And then also by a British writer, Paul Kingsnorth, who makes the point, you know, who argues we are as gods and we're pretty bad at it. You know, we're very destructive gods. So all of these perspectives are out there, and I think there's truth to all of them. I mean, we obviously exercise tremendous influence on the natural world. We, you know, we live in this geological epoch that has been dubbed the Anthropocene, the age of man. We right. now, you know, definitely equal many of the great forces of nature in our impacts on the world. And, you know, are we just wreaking havoc? Are we just kind of like, you know, the gods in the myth who, you know, tromp around and mere mortals get destroyed, you know, or are we going to wise up, I suppose? Can we wise up? Can we ever intervene in these systems, which are so complicated, which predate us, which took, you know, billions of years to evolve through a process of trial and error? Can we intervene in them using, you know, human ingenuity in a way that where we can anticipate all of the after effects? And that's, I think, really the big question of our time right now.
As you go through the world and talk to these various people and tell us these stories of what they are up to intervene in one way or another, they have the chance perhaps of being a god, but you as the author don't think of it that way. You obviously are looking at it saying, okay, but well, what else could happen?
Well, let's take an example that's reasonably close to home. So one of the sort of the center of the book is it deals with gene editing, which has become, yeah, you know, a lot easier and a lot cheaper owing to CRISPR. And I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with that. So, you know, CRISPR is just a suite of gene editing techniques that have really revolutionized gene editing, made it possible. I mean, in the book, I buy a kit and I gene edit some bacteria in my kitchen, you know, so it's really kind of incredible. And people are looking at using gene editing to try to save species. That's probably possible. For example, we have a pretty good example right here, you know, in New York State, where scientists in Syracuse have developed a chestnut tree, an American chestnut tree, that is immune to chestnut blight or resistant to chestnut blight. And that involves importing a single gene from wheat into that tree. Now, those trees, I've seen those trees. They're sitting in fence plots because they need federal permits to allow them to be planted out in the world. Now, do we want to have, you know, chestnut trees, transgenic chestnut trees? They will not be exactly like the originals, but they'll be pretty close. But, you know, gene editing species raises a lot of very profound, you know, ethical and scientific questions. You know, so do we want a world in which we are tinkering with the genomes of all the creatures around us? If that's the only way to save a species, would we be willing to do that? So these are huge questions looming over us, and they really do, to many people's minds, and I think we're getting pretty close to asking the question of, yes, who gets to decide? You know, this is a conscious decision of which species we manipulate and which one gets to survive. Now, I would argue we are unconsciously, unwittingly, just willy-nilly doing that all the time. So the question is, are, you know, as Stuart Brand said, are we going to get good at this?
Right. You have a chapter in the book on carbon dioxide removal, and it seems that you find this to be one of the promising things that you've looked at, but the jury's still out, obviously.
Yeah. So carbon dioxide removal is a pretty interesting one, because we've sort of already factored it into, you know, when people say, let's keep the average global temperature below, you know, 2 degrees Celsius, let's keep it from rising above more than 2 degrees Celsius, in sort of already built into that is, can we remove carbon? Because, you know, we're sort of probably going to go over that. Are we going to be able to take some of that carbon out of the air? So there's a lot resting on whether we can do that. I actually went to visit some of my emissions that had been scrubbed out of the air. I went to a place in Iceland where they suck carbon out of the air and shove it underground, and it turns to stone. It was a really interesting trip, a fascinating trip. Now, can you do that, you know, at scale where you're doing billions and billions of tons a year? That is a question that remains to be answered.
You write about that very simply in the book, as if, like, you get an email and you're like, well, sign me up for this. And then the next thing you know, you've rented a car and you're driving through Iceland, which I just think is, I'm sure it was more complicated than that.
Well, also a point that I make in the book is, you know, as soon as I got on that plane to go to Iceland, I sort of negated the value of having had them take my mission from there because I creating more emissions. The math is very, very punishing.
You know, I want to get back to gene editing for a minute. And just because, I mean, some of this can be frightening.
I think the two sort of, you know, most, you know, the two technologies that really raise the biggest questions in the book are a form of gene editing that's called gene drive, where you are not only editing a creature, but you're sort of programming a creature to gene edit itself. And so you can really take a trait and push it out into the world. And there are already these mosquitoes that have been edited with a gene drive. The idea of the gene drive is to basically spread a trait that makes it very hard for these mosquitoes to reproduce, so to fight malaria. Now, if you let those mosquitoes out in the world, are you going to sort of get rid of every mosquito in the world? That is a very interesting question, an important question. Maybe people would like to get rid of mosquitoes, but it does raise a lot of questions. And the other one I think that really, you know, freaks people out, and reasonably so, is solar geoengineering. Are we really going to, you know, dim the sun? That is really what the technology would do.
The new book is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future, and it is published by Crown. Isn't what we're living through right now, this global pandemic, really part of what we're talking about, in the sense of you have this natural thing that is a virus, and it then goes into a species, and because of the way we live, it becomes global, and then we can't stop it because it goes everywhere immediately. So then we think, okay, it's everywhere. Well, now let's try to fix it. And that fix, of course, is a vaccine. And as we're figuring that out, oh, by the way, the virus is changing, and all of these variants are happening. And I don't know, last count, I think we're up to, what, 3 boosters we're going to need, and that's as of today. So, but that plays into exactly what you're talking about in the book, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think COVID is a classic example of, you know, how we deal with these problems that are sort of coupled human and natural systems, right? So as you suggest, you know, these spillover events where a virus jumps species, that's what happened. You know, that's how COVID got into the human population. It came from some other species, we don't know which at this point. And it jumped into the human population. And then because of the way we live in a globalized world, right, spillover events have happened throughout history. But because of the way humans live in 2020, it was immediately everywhere. You know, it was in the Falkland Islands very quickly. So it was everywhere. And then even then, we could have taken steps to really try to tamp it down, control it very vigorously. We would have had to all stay home, you know, under complete lockdown. We didn't do that. We let it just rage completely out of control. And then, as you say, we are now waiting for a techno fix. That's a vaccine, right, which was developed using cutting edge technology, these mRNA vaccines, really cutting edge. But meanwhile, the virus has ideas of its own, you know, and it is mutating very fast because it is everywhere, because it is so widespread now. It has many, many, you know, possibilities to evolve in many, many different people and recombine. And so, as you say, we're seeing the potential for what's called vaccine escape, and where we'll need constant vaccines. And where the disease, where COVID, I think, will become endemic. So it's just going to always be around, you know, like the flu. It's just something we're never not going to be living with. And that is very much the situation, you know, that I'm talking about, where, you know, we don't do the social kinds of control things that we might do to keep something under control. We let it get out of control. And then we sit here and say, okay, we're going to have to do something really radical, perhaps dim the sun to deal with it.
You know, this is probably a bad segue, but I have to say that in coming on these very big issues that we've been talking about, that as I say at the beginning of each book show, that this is a show about reading and writers. And you do a masterful job in this, because this book is really funny. It's scary stuff. It's important stuff, but it is a dark comedy, and you seem to have a twinkle in your eye as you're writing it, because it's beautifully done in a way that's like, okay, and then this happened.
Well, I really appreciate your bringing that up, because I know this stuff is really heavy, and it sometimes sounds like the book, you know, is really heavy sledding, and it I hope it isn't. It was fun to write. I know that sounds weird. It was fun. I had great adventures, and I hope the kind of absurdity, and as you say, the dark comedy of our situation, as opposed to just the depressing aspects of it, also come through in the book.
And it's sort of all we have, right? I mean, we have to sort of kind of sit back and just watch it unfold and see what happens.
Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, one of my own personal favorite, you know, social bits of social commentary, let's call it that, is Dr. Strangelove, which is, you know, as everyone knows, a hilarious movie about just about the heaviest subject, you know, there could be, nuclear holocaust. So I do think that, you know, dark comedy often does get at really important issues that are very hard for people to, you know, to read about if it's just unrelentingly grim.
Tell me about Ruth Gates and the who passed away as you were writing this book, but the Imagine Project and what ultimately brought you to the Great Coral Reef.
So Ruth Gates is a very wonderful, dynamic woman, a marine scientist, and that was really the origins of the book, was her project. She was working on something that became nicknamed the Super Coral Project. And I went to visit that about 4 years ago in Hawaii. And the idea behind the Super Coral Project was, you know, owing to climate change, owing to having dumped billions of tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, that we have altered the oceans really dramatically. Both their temperature is increasing, and also their chemistry is changing. And reefs, we know that one group of organisms that really isn't doing well in the oceans of today, so not even the oceans of the future, but the oceans of today, is reef-building corals, these tiny gelatinous animals that build reefs. And so Ruth's point with this project was, if you want reefs to survive the 21st century, and they're ecologically extremely important, you know, coral reefs, then we're going to have to intervene again. We've already, you know, intervened in the oceans. We've already changed the oceans. We're going to have to now try to change these corals to enable them to survive this changed ocean. And that idea that, you know, you have to intervene on top of an intervention, that really struck me as sort of a new chapter, as it were, in our long and complicated relationship to the natural world. And I really started to see, you know, Ruth made a big impression on me, And as I say, she's very smart, very dynamic, very charismatic. And I started to sort of see this pattern all around me. And that sort of became the genesis of the book.
And what you won't do for a good story for the book, but you actually got hit by an Asian carp.
Yes, yes. The book begins, we're on a trip down what's called the Chicago Sanitary and Ship Canal. And it's actually a man-made waterway that was designed to change the direction of the Chicago River, which used to flow into Lake Michigan and now flows out of Lake Michigan, so that Chicago sewage is not dumped into Lake Michigan, which is the source of Chicago's drinking water. But that project had the unintended consequence, you're sort of getting the theme here, of uniting, joining together the Great Lakes watershed and the Mississippi watershed. An Asian carp, which are a highly invasive species, actually several species, are working their way toward the Great Lakes. And so I took a trip down this canal to a portion of the canal that is now electrified. Literally, if you went into the water, you could probably kill yourself, to try to keep the carp, to try to dissuade the carp from moving from the Mississippi system into the Great Lakes. And on another trip to Illinois, I managed to get myself hit by an Asian carp, which have the unfortunate habit of flinging themselves out of the water. And they're really big fish. They're like 80 yeah. pounds. So I got hit in the leg and it was painful, but it was no big deal. But I met people who'd had their eye sockets broken. I mean, really, they are very, very, that can be really dangerous if you get hit by a flying Asian carp.
Elizabeth, it's always a great pleasure to have you on the program. The name of the new book is Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. The book is published by Crown. I thank you so much, as always, for you being here.
Thanks, Joe.
Again, Elizabeth Colbert's new book, Under a White Sky, The Nature of the Future. It is published by Crown. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. This show was recorded as part of a virtual author event with Oblong Books and Music, oblongbooks.com. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.